What I'd like to talk about today is making ultra-cold molecules, not necessarily Bose condensed molecules, but I do want to touch on that as well. I think it's a very exciting area, sort of an extension of the laser cooling and trapping area. There was an interesting comment made by the report of the National Research Council on Atomic Molecular and Optical Science. They listed two technical priorities, and one of those priorities was to promote research that promises new technologies to better control and manipulate atoms, molecules, charged particles, and light. And of course, charged particles and light have been manipulated for a long time. We know about the remarkable advances in manipulation and control of atoms in recent years, but molecules are much harder, and hopefully you'll appreciate that a little bit more after my talk today. However, there has been quite a bit of progress. The concept of optical cooling of molecules, for example, goes back to 1950. Cooling them to ultra-cold temperatures, however, will be the focus today. And really, that's only been discussed extensively in the last couple of years. And I'll say more about these different approaches later in my talk. There are two other very interesting related approaches that I won't talk about. One is using quantum clusters, large clusters of helium or hydrogen molecules, with helium obtaining about 400 millikelvin temperatures by Jacinto Scolis and Peter Tonis and others. And the second one is using a magnetic trap for atoms and molecules, and with buffer gas cooling with helium-3, achieving temperatures of the order of a quarter of a kelvin. Now, what I want to talk about today is summarized here. First, talk a little bit about the applications of ultra-cold molecules and what the prospects are, in some sense, for Bose-Einstein condensation of molecules. Then talk about photoassociative spectroscopy, which is really the enabling information that you need in order to prepare ultra-cold molecules by optical techniques. Both the one color and two color, or if you like, the single photon and the double resonant excitation. And finally, talk about making state-selected and translationally ultra-cold molecules. The one state that you can select is the lowest vibration rotational level, which would then make it a fully ultra-cold molecule, vibrationally, rotationally, and translationally. And another approach I want to talk about would be starting with a collection of translationally ultra-cold molecules in a variety of vibration rotational states and then internally cooling them while trapping them in, say, a far-off resonant trap. And an alternative approach is a stimulated Raman photoassociation of the ultra-cold atoms that are colliding into ultra-cold molecules in a selected internal state. So if you look at applications of these cold gaseous molecules, obviously one thing you'd like to do is molecular trapping in a far-off resonant trap or a magnetic trap for paramagnetic molecules. Do molecular optics, the analog of atom optics. Do ultra-cold collisions, not just elastic, but the inelastic and reactive collisions, and look at the low temperature limit. Nucleation is another interesting topic. Bose-Einstein condensation, the topic of this meeting, and the related idea of a molecule laser, starting with a Bose condensate. Now, this is a quick summary of atoms and molecules. Let's see if we can get that a little better. Let's see, where's the focus on this? Well, I guess it's close. Rotate the lens here. Okay. Of course, the atomic spin-polarized hydrogen with a positive scattering length was the first proposed Bose condensation of dilute gases. And if you go down the list, of course, lithium, sodium, and rubidium have all been Bose condensed. Hydrogen is close, at MIT in the Kleppner-Greytak lab, and I think the potassium isotopes with large positive scattering lengths are also very promising candidates for Bose condensation. If you go to molecules, however, the situation is much, much less certain. Now, let me just move that up. looking at the potentials for H2, para-H2, that is V equals 0, J equals 0, H2, interacting with another H2 molecule, it appears that the scattering length is probably positive for that interaction, and the possibility of dilute H2 gas Bose condensing, I think, is a realistic possibility, although certainly not near term. It also appears that both the deuterium and tritium scattering lengths may be negative, in which case they would not be good possibilities. But if you go to the alkalis, and of course there are lots of various alkali dimers, here I've only written the homopolar molecules. They're not homonuclear because in many cases they can have two different nuclei within the molecule. One knows almost nothing about the scattering lengths, whether they're positive or negative for any of these species. So with V equals 0 and J equals 0, a good fraction of those probably will have positive scattering lengths. There's also the possibility that the ortho species, or at least the J equal 1 species, which is not always called ortho, in lithium-6 and potassium-40, it would be called para, the J equal 1 level. That's probably sufficiently metastable that you can also consider that in terms of a Bose-Einstein condensation. So there's quite a rich variety of these species, and one of the questions is how to make them cold and how to trap them and so forth. And I thought I'd go through just a quick example to get to the topic we discussed yesterday of rich structure. This is the case of the dimers with a nuclear spin of 3 halves, which includes all of these alkali isotopes. In that case, the total nuclear spin can be 0, 1, 2, or 3. And if you then look at the overall anti-symmetry with respect to the interchange of the nuclei, you realize right away that the J equals 0 version of the dimer, the para alkali dimer, there will be 6 nuclear spin states and 1 rotational state. For the ortho version, there will be a total of 10 nuclear spin states and 3 rotational states, so a total of 30 internal states if you were trying to Bose condense this molecule. Now, of course, with magnetic or electric fields, you can cut the number down, but it's still going to be a very complex type of Bose condensate. And here I've just done the calculation for all of the alkali dimers. So potassium-40, for example, will have 45 different internal states for J equals 0 and 108 for J equals 1. So it will indeed be a rich structure, which I don't think anybody has really talked about. I certainly would appreciate knowing about work on molecular BECs because I haven't found much in the literature. And anyway, let's see. Now, where did that transparency go? Okay. So what I want to talk about now is the area of photoassociative spectroscopy, which is really the tool that enables us to figure out how to try to make ultra-cold molecules. And you start, of course, with colliding atoms. And the remarkable thing about working in a magneto-optical trap is that the atomic kinetic energies of collision are comparable or smaller than things like fine structure, hyperfine structure, Stark effects, Zeeman effects, isotope shifts, centrifugal barriers, and natural line width. Normally, it's reversed, and your thermal energy is large compared to all of those things. You're in the other limit, and so there are a vast variety of permutations and combinations which make this a very interesting regime for collision dynamics. Here are the centrifugal barriers, for example, and let's focus on potassium, which I'll spend most of the time on. This is a plotting of the potentials from 20 to 150 angstroms. And of course, a head-on collision, an S-wave collision, is purely attractive with an order of the minus 6 interaction. The P-wave has a very small barrier of about 300 microkelvin, which is about KT in our dark spot magneto-optical trap for potassium. And the D-wave has a barrier of about 1.2 millikelvin. So the photo association not only has a very specific energy, the energy of collision is the order of 7 megahertz in collisional energy, but the angular momentum is also specified to be 0, 1, or 2 to a good approximation. And so the spectrum becomes very, very simple. The area of photo association really goes way back to the 30s, but photo associating ultra-cold atoms is really the big advance, because the spectroscopy that you do when you have a very well-defined energy initially in the continuum and a very well-defined set of angular momenta gives you spectra that look like bound-bound spectra, as opposed to normal photo association of thermal atoms where you see simply broad continua. And so this was really pointed out by Thorsheim, Julian, and Weiner, and there are now a number of very successful groups. Randy will be talking later this afternoon, and I guess promises one transparency on photo association, but it's very exciting to see the information that you can obtain by this technique. So let me make a quick comparison between normal molecular spectroscopy, which in sodium, for example, occurs at about 3 angstroms internuclear distance, and could be a single photon excitation or double resonance, or you could actually do triple resonance. We've done quite a bit of that in sodium too. In those cases, you can find out about these interaction potentials at distances out to perhaps 10, occasionally 20, in exceptional cases 30 or farther, but you're really restricted to this region of internuclear distance. On the other hand, when you're doing the photo association, you're typically sensitive to distance of tens to hundreds of angstroms, and I'll give you some more precise numbers later on. And this is the single photon photo association, and then this is an example of double resonant photo association, which can both be done in the pump probe type, or it could also be in the pump dump variety. And both Randy Hewlett and Dan Heinzen have some very nice measurements of the double resonance where they can find out about the ground state scattering lengths from such spectroscopy. Now, this is a typical photoassociative spectrum. This is for potassium, and vibrational frequencies of molecules are typically hundreds or thousands of wave numbers. However, this is 2.4 wave numbers, the total scale, and these represent many vibrational spacings in 3 different electronic states of diatomic potassium. And the green, red, and blue states, and we'll say more about these, and the slides later are color-coded with these appropriate colors. The strongest transition is this 0U+. The 1G state is this red case, and then there's a special kind of state called a pure long-range state, coded in green, which is a state which has a minimum sitting out at 28 angstroms, not 3 angstroms as in the case of ground state of sodium, but it's sitting way out on the long range region of the potential. Now, what is plotted here is the trap fluorescence. So we're looking at the fluorescence from the trap. That's basically this background here. And every once in a while you get this dip in trap fluorescence, and the reason you get the dip is that you're forming, from colliding pairs of atoms, bound molecules. When those bound molecules decay, there are basically two options. You have free-to-bound absorption. You form an excited molecule in a particular vibration-rotational level that can emit to give a molecule, which, of course, is not atomic and doesn't give atomic fluorescence and leaves the trap. You can have cold atoms, which is where you started, that don't leave the trap, but you can also have an increase in kinetic energy of the atoms after the bound free emission, and trap loss if the relative kinetic energy is the order of a degree Kelvin or more, which is roughly the trap depth in our experiments. So we understand what these probabilities are from ordinary molecular spectra, and we understand with the branching into the molecular bound states and into the different parts of the free states. Recently, Cote and Dalgono have done a very careful analysis of Li2 and the branching into these different components, which is a nice example. Now, I'm not going to say much about experiment except to emphasize the magneto-optical trap that we uses no cryogenics. It's a cell trap. It traps about 20 million atoms, and the temperature is about 300 microkelvin. These are all F equal 1 hyperfine state, and a density greater than 10 to the 11th per cubic centimeter. Now, how do we interpret those spectra? Just quickly, the normal molecular state designations are given on the left, corresponding to short internuclear distances, where the spin and the projection, spin S, and the projection of the electronic angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, lambda, are the good quantum numbers, as well as the UG parity symmetry. The designations, however, at long range are different. What's listed is capital Omega, which is the 0 or 1 or 2 for these states and represents the sum of the projections of the spin and electronic orbital angular momentum on the internuclear axis. And again, there's UG symmetry as well. Now, as you go from short distances out to larger distances, and for potassium, this boundary here is about 11 to 16 angstroms, the pairs of sigma and pi states come together in the sense I've shown here. They have an exchange splitting. The exchange splitting decays exponentially, and you get two states that are almost identical in their potential energy curves, like the blue and red state that I showed you the spectrum of. And in this case, they have a long-range attractive R to the minus 3 potential, and they are very similar in their behavior with vibrational level. Now, this can be attractive, as it is for these states, or repulsive, as it is for those states. And, of course, in the ground state, it's an attractive C6 interaction. As you go farther out, what you find is that you approach these two fine structure states, and in some sense, these C3 coefficients are with respect to the spin orbit averaged asymptote. If you get into the details, you really have to worry about diagonalizing 2x2 or 3x3 matrices, for example. There's a 1G state here, and a 1G state here, and another 1G state there, and so you don't get this simple R to the minus N. Every matrix element in this 2x2 or 3x3 matrix is of that form, but the structure with internuclear distance is rather interesting, and three of the states, including this purple and green state here, actually have these long distance minima. These are these pure long range molecular states. So if you start down here with colliding atoms, the possible Hund's-Kaye-C state designations are shown there, 0G plus, 0U minus, and 1U, with the selection rules and requiring that the state have bound states upstairs, not be purely repulsive. There are a total of 7 possible states that could be observed, and we've seen all 7 of those. We'll focus today just on the states up here, not on these down here, but we've also seen those. So what happens? Well, this shows the potential curves, and in particular the green, red, and blue states, and also this purple state, which is very shallow and hard to observe. These two states have minima at 28 and 39 angstroms, and they have a well depth of out of 13,000 wave numbers for the excitation energy of potassium. The well depth here is only 6 wave numbers and about half a wave number for the purple state. So these are very subtle details of the potential curve in one sense, but quite observable spectroscopically. If you take any of those spectra that I showed you earlier and you begin to expand the scale, you notice rotational structure, and also you can see weakly here for the stronger transitions, you can see the weak evidence for 1 plus 2 collisions as well as 1 plus 1 collisions in the photoassociation. And I'll blow up some rotational structure in the next transparency. And you can see how close together some of the rotational lines are. These are about 50 megahertz apart. So this is a very, very small rotational constant in the case of K2. Now, this spectrum actually is plotted in the other direction because it's a different kind of detection used for the absorption. And let me say just a word about that. In this case, we're doing molecular ionization starting after the absorption event and going to higher asymptotes and ionizing the molecule that's formed. Now, in this case, you can't observe this in the ordinary trap loss fluorescence spectrum that I showed you earlier and in the previous example with rotational structure. And it's easy to understand that. As you vibrate back and forth in this very shallow 6 wave number deep well, you only have the order of 2/10 of a Kelvin maximum in local kinetic energy. And so when this state fluoresces to the lower asymptote, the only possibilities are to make cold atoms. You can't make hot atoms that can escape the trap. You can't make molecules that can escape the trap. And therefore, there's no trap loss and no drop in the fluorescence. So this lowest vibrational level cannot be observed by trap loss, and you have to do something else like this molecular ionization. But these are complementary, and there are many cases where we have spectra taken both ways that agree very well with each other. Now, one of the things you like to do as well is to make the connection with what's happening at short distance. And this is the summary. I'll only focus on one here today, this red state, for which we have data corresponding to about 22 to 109 angstrom outer turning points of these red vibrational levels. So we're sensitive to that region of internuclear distance. And the molecular spectroscopy at short distance done in Lyon by Amanda Ross and co-workers very nicely determines the short distance potential out to about 16 angstroms. So there's actually quite a small gap between the long-range data and the short-range data, and that gap is being closed now. They have some new results which we haven't yet assimilated, but going beyond 16 angstroms in the molecular spectroscopy. So that's an interesting thing to be able to do. That allows you to generate the total potential curve and make some of the accurate calculations for things like molecule formation by absorption and emission of light. This shows these pure long-range molecular states in a little more detail. There's also a third curve within extremum that has a barrier rather than a well, but it's a similar origin in each case. You start with a long-range coefficient that's attractive or repulsive, and as you come into short distance, you couple with other states of the same symmetry, such as 0g minus or 1u, and then at short distance, you recouple the angular momenta, and the sign of the long-range force has changed. And you get a repulsive interaction in this case rather than an attractive interaction just by the interaction of these small number of eigenstates. Now, what's shown here are actually three theoretical calculations of what that potential curve should look like. And the last one is almost indistinguishable from the experimental best fit called this work, which represents fitting the eigenvalues for levels 0 up to 30 in this potential well to obtain the best C3, C6, C8 coefficients to then use in constructing not only this potential, but all of the sets of potentials which depend on these same long-range coefficients, just different combinations. One actually has to, in this case, also make corrections for retardation and non-adiabaticity. Those are relatively small. And the final result in terms of the long-range coefficients is shown here. Fitting levels up to V equal 30, we get these C3 coefficients, these C6 coefficients. They differ by only 2 and 1% from the results of Marinescu and Dalgarno, which are first principles calculations of these same quantities. So it's a very nice agreement. Also, we might mention that the C3 coefficient here is related to the dipole matrix element of the atom between the 4s and the 4p state, and therefore to the radiative lifetime. And so the best radiative lifetime, actually, I guess, for all the alkalis except cesium is now obtained from photoassociative data, from molecular spectra. This just shows the comparison for potassium. These are older measurements of potassium. This is a fast beam measurement at Kaiserslautern. This is based on the molecular spectra, and these are three theoretical calculations. So sort of interesting to use molecular spectra to determine atomic properties. One thing you can do is very nicely predict where the 1U state is. After we saw the 0G minus, we predicted where the 1U was, and we found it. It was right where it was predicted, to a hundredth of a wave number, something like that. Again, using the molecular ionization process, one step up, another step to ionize. And this just shows the spectrum. Spectra get complicated as you approach the dissociation limit because of hyperfine structure. Below is a simulation done by Tiesinger and Julian of this spectrum. And you can see for higher rotational quantum numbers, you have basically a rigid rotor-type spectra with hyperfine splitting. But when you go down to the low rotational quantum numbers, you get many, many different levels. And both rotation and hyperfine are very strongly mixed, and it's very difficult to assign things. We're now in the process of trying to calculate the intensities of these transitions, but we're quite sure from the vibrational spacings alone that this is this very weakly bound 1U state of K2. Now, this is the first singlet pi G state shown over sort of its full range. Out to about 16 angstroms is the experimental RKR from ordinary molecular spectra. The line coming in here is purely the theoretical calculation of Marinescu and Dalgarno. And, you know, unless you have very good eyes, it looks like it's doing very well. But in fact, there's about a three-wave number discrepancy between theory and experiment. However, if you now use the C3, C6 coefficients determined by the fit to the 0G minus, it falls right on top of the RKR over this entire range with an average deviation of less than 2/10 of a wave number. So it's a very nice connection between short and long range, and that's a state we want to use in trying to form molecules, so it's important to know that potential curve very well. Another approach is to go to the higher asymptotes of K2, and one of the reasons for doing that is the Band-Julian proposal that rather than using a single photon absorption to try to make molecules, you actually want to do a double two-color excitation. And in this case, this is a spectrum I showed you earlier, and now what we're doing is we're fixing this first laser on this strong peak here and tuning now this second laser to see the structure at the 5D asymptote or one of these other asymptotes. And because this zero-point level is very restricted in internuclear distance, only going from about 28 plus or minus an angstrom and a half, you get a very nice projection on the upper state potential curve, and you can very easily assign the spectra. So here are some spectra passing through this V equals zero level, this Frank Condon window, if you like. And what you see, for example, at the 6S asymptote is a series of five vibrational levels, all with rotational structure. As you go to the higher levels, you lose the rotational structure, we believe, because of fast autoionization. And for some of the intermediate states, like the 5D, you actually get rotational structure for low vibrational quantum numbers, but autoionization removes the rotational structure for higher quantum numbers. Now, this is all with the narrowest window. You, of course, can open the window by going to higher vibrational levels. And this is an example of doing that at this asymptote. So again, we'll see these four vibrational levels. We'll see these two atomic lines. We actually see some structure which we haven't interpreted yet down at the bottom. These are the four old levels. You see additional levels. One's under the atomic line, and three more, and this one is just very, very weakly bound, but it's definitely there in the spectrum. And if you do a standard long-range analysis, you plot the binding energy to the one-third power for an R⁻⁶ potential, and you plot that versus vibrational quantum number, that should be a straight line, and you see it is a straight line to a good approximation. And you can then compare that also with long-range coefficients, and it's in quite good agreement between theory and experiment. Another type of two-color experiment which we found very powerful is related to fine structure changing collisions, which is an important trap loss process in magneto-optical traps, where if you change from the P3 halves to the P1 half in potassium, you release 56 wave numbers of kinetic energy and the atoms escape the trap. We haven't studied this, but we've studied the half-collision analog of that, going below the dissociation limit at, if you like, negative energies, both for the 0U plus and the 1G. Now, the 0U plus is what is predominantly important in this process, according to Julian and Vigay, and so we expect right at the limit we'll see mainly 0U plus pre-dissociation. What we didn't expect and what we did find was 1G pre-dissociation as well, and we detect this by detecting the fragment, the P1 half atom, by resonant enhanced multiphoton ionization. So the process is summarized here for the blue and red states. If you were coming in on this asymptote, these would be Feshbach resonances, 0U plus and 1G. And they predissociate, and then we detect the P1 half by two-photon resonant ionization. So let's see what the spectra look like. This is a little bit busy, but interesting nevertheless. Start at the bottom. This is the trap loss spectrum, very similar to the one I showed you originally with the red, blue, and green. Left the green out here for simplicity. And down at the bottom is the ion signal from ionizing the P1 half atoms. And what you see right away is that the ion signals match up with the 0U pluses, but they don't match up with the red 1G state. And that's true all the way across here. However, it's a long way from this asymptote down to P1 half. And as you keep going down, you see the blue gets weaker and weaker, and then the red starts to come in. You start to get predissociation of the other state, and pretty soon the blue has disappeared and you've got the red, and the red continues on and then abruptly stops, even though we continue to see trap loss spectra. So there are more vibrational levels, but we're not seeing them by this fragmentation into P1 half atom. And I'm not going to go into the details of why this is the case. Let me just show you the one simple example. It's easy to understand. The 1G state, which we see from 105 down to 91, is crossed by another state of Gerada symmetry at about 20-some angstroms, and it's just below the V equal 91 level. V equal 90 would not significantly predissociate, and we don't observe it in the predissociation. The Other predissociation is more complex. It involves two curve crossings and spin orbit coupling. If anybody's interested, I can talk to them about it later. So given that we know a lot about these molecular states, both at long distance and short distance, in a molecule like K2, the question is, how do we make translationally ultra-cold molecules? Well, if you just want to make molecules that are translationally ultra-cold and you don't care about the internal state distribution, the best of the states that we see is actually the 0U+ state going to the P1/2 asymptote, which becomes the A state at short distance. And in that case, you would photoassociate the molecule to various vibration rotational levels, and that would then fluoresce to ground state molecules. And you can make a lot of ground state molecules that way. Unfortunately, one of the disadvantages is you make ground state molecules that go from the very low levels to the very high levels. And it's a very broad distribution and very difficult to subsequently laser cool. And so this was really realized by Band and Julian, and so they proposed a double excitation, a double resonant excitation of higher excited states, for example, Rydberg states, and that's summarized here. You would photoassociate, for example, to this red state, the first singlet pi g, which is 1 g at long range, and then you would excite that at short distance up to a Rydberg state. The Rydberg state, either sigma or pi, would then fluoresce down to the ground state. And the real difference is you get a quite narrow distribution of vibrational levels, typically 0 to 9 in K2, for example. And so I have a set of theoretical potential curves in this case from Kanawalu and co-workers, the spaghetti of potential curves. And I've highlighted a few of those. We would photoassociate from colliding atoms up to high levels of the 1G state. And we know this full potential curve into short distance. A number like V equal 100, about V equal 90 is probably a good one, actually. And then let me overlay this with the actual transitions that would be pumped. So with the turning point here, you can pump low vibrational levels of Rydberg states, and the fluorescence from those Rydberg states will go to low vibrational levels in the ground state. And we think we know how to laser cool a narrow vibrational distribution, such as that distribution in K2. The point, then, is that if you were making translationally ultra-cold molecules by this, what's now called the Band-Julian approach, the two-color approach for exciting excited states, first of all, you'll already be rotationally cold because you're going through this photoassociative process in the first step, and that only involves a few partial waves of collision. You're selecting one of those in many cases, like going to the 1G state. So you might select a J equal 1 or J equal 2 or J equal 3 peak, and that's the only angular momentum you have to worry about. In fluorescence, you can have a branching to two or even three lower rotational levels. And then you would internally cool this narrow distribution of vibrational levels in the ground state of the molecule. And let me just summarize that schematically here. Here we have a case where a given upper level doesn't emit to 0 to 9, but only 0 to 2, only three vibrational levels with significant Frank-Condon factors. The difference between cooling atoms and cooling molecules is instead of having a two-level system approximately where you can cycle back and forth many, many times, maybe you need a repumping laser to take care of low-probability decay to other hyperfine states. But basically, it's closed cycle very easily in an atom. To get the equivalent closed cycle in a molecule is much more difficult, and it involves taking all the transitions down to very small Frank-Condon factors, the order of 10 to the minus 5 Frank-Condon factors. So assume for the moment that this set of six lower and one upper level satisfy that condition, that there's no emission from this level to V equal 3, for example, to the order of a part per million. Then if you can generate these six frequencies, you can optically couple these seven levels. And if you block any one of those six transitions, you can dump the population into the one dark state. And so that could be V equals 0, J equals 0, in which case you'd be internally ultra-cold, or it could be some other level like 2, 2 in this bottom example. That's equally a good state to dump into. Now, the way in which we actually are trying to implement this is shown here. And the general procedures for cooling a supersonic beam. If you, however, are making translationally ultra-cold molecules in a magneto-optical trap, you really don't need to do the translational cooling, and you don't need to do the rotational cooling. All you need is this last step. So in this case, you take a individual pump line of the molecule, and you generate the stimulated Raman sidebands, in this case from V equals 0 to V equals 9. You do this in a separate sample of the same molecule, like cesium-2, if you were trying to cool cesium-2. In that case, then to do the vibrational rotational cooling, you'd have population in all levels, say J equals 0 and 2 from 0 up to 9. You'd simply block the last line here, this line to V equals 0 and J equals 0, and then spontaneous emission would put all the population in this lowest level. Now, more recently, and I apologize for the quality of these transparencies, we've been thinking a lot about another approach, which is a stimulated Raman approach. It's related to something that Klaus Bergmann and co-workers at Kaiserslautern have been pursuing for about a decade, I guess. It's a very interesting process where you can coherently transfer population from one level to a second level by a stimulated Raman process in a molecule like K2 or sodium-2. Starting in a low level, for example, is what Bergmann has done in his experiments, done in supersonic molecular beams, pump and dump to high vibrational levels in the ground state. And that's been done, as I said, with 100% population transfer. Now, this adiabatic passage is done in a counterintuitive pulse sequence where you actually provide this laser first, overlapped in time with the second laser here. And in doing that, you avoid any real population in the upper level, which is labeled 3 here. So you're going adiabatically from level 1 to a superposition of 1 and 2 into pure 2 without ever having a component of 3. And, of course, that's related to lots of other quantum optics things, but I won't talk about that today. Now, a thing that occurred to us a number of years ago and also to Moshe Shapiro and co-workers in Israel is that you might be able to do this where one was not a low vibrational level but a continuum level. And, in fact, last year in Journal of Chemical Physics, there's a nice paper by Shapiro and co-workers where they take temperature and densities typical of a magneto-optical trap and claim that, again, you can get 100% population transfer via photoassociation dumping to a vibrational level, state selectively, in the ground state of the molecule. There's also a proposal involving Paul Julian, Keith Burdett, Yehuda Band, and myself to convert, to use this process at even lower temperatures and to convert an atomic Bose-Einstein condensate into a molecular laser, and that's been submitted to PhysRevA. This would be a state-selected coherent beam of this level. Now, the best Frank Condon factors would be to go to 195 here and 36 down here. If you want ultra-cold molecules, you'd like to go to the bottom, but you don't want to start with the hardest transition. So one certain possibility is to try to make high vibrational levels in a magneto-optical trap, and Ed Eiler's group and my group are collaborating on this at the moment. There's one other complication beyond this, which may sound a little weird, but probably can be done. If you can do triple resonance, you can do quadruple resonance, and this is an example where you would start by doing the stimulated photorecombination to this level, which is labeled 2 here, and then you would do a sort of an inverse stirrup process, which we know can be done efficiently, back to level 1 prime, this very low level, which might be the very coldest level in the molecule, V equals 0, J equals 0. So hopefully I've given you a quick overview of some of the ways in which we're approaching molecules as a extension of laser-cooled and trapped atoms to try to see if some of the things that have been done for atoms can in fact be done for molecules as well. And certainly a real nice goal would be Bose-Einstein condensation of ultra-cold molecules. So let me stop and ask for your comments and questions. Thank you. Right. These are homonuclear molecules. There's no infrared transition. Right. I mean, it might work in a molecule like potassium rubidium or something. That's something else we've thought about, but that's another level of complexity to start making heteronuclear ultra-cold molecules. Yeah. Okay. No. There are no inelastic channels except these nuclear spin and M sub J degrees of freedom for ortho and para hydrogen, assuming that the ortho doesn't convert. Right. Oh, yeah, we're talking about long-term prepping. The far-off resonant trap would be the logical thing to try. Right. Right, I mean, the point is there are no open channels for V equals 0, J equals 0 of one molecule, and V equals 0, J equals 0 of another molecule to collide and then come out. I mean, you could say, are you going to make a trimer and an atom, for example? That's endo-ergic. It won't happen. Okay. One of the nice things is you know a lot of the energetics in these systems, and even the trimer, and even the quartet trimer now, as well as the doublet trimer. Right. That's right. Yeah.
Is it obvious that there's anything that you can do with a Bose-condensated molecule that you can't do with a Bose-condensated alpha ion?
Well, I mean, obviously there are collision dynamics that will be different. And I think whether or not you can form Bose-condensate, one of the interesting things that you can do, for example, PA and co-workers have made lots of triplet molecules of cesium-2 and seeing them fall out of a trap. Now, will those triplet molecules be able to collide with each other and not relax in some way? If that's possible, then you could even think about trying to get high densities of triplet molecules as well as singlet molecules. So there's a lot of possibilities for metastability of various forms. The ortho case, the J equal 1 levels being the simplest example, but I think there are some other examples that might work as well.
More questions? If not, then we thank the speaker again.
Thank you.